Let's report next on an author with a very wide reach.
People use him to learn and also to teach.
You'd know his books the second they're brought in the door.
And you would recognize his words when read on the Senate floor.
I would not like them here or there. I would not like them anywhere. I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them. Sam, I am.
That's Senator Ted Cruz reading another Ted, Theodore Geisel, better known as Dr. Seuss, on the Senate floor. Now, Dr. Seuss died in 1991, but a new collection called Horton and the Quaggerbug and More Lost Stories comes out tomorrow. NPR's Seuss correspondent Lauren McGaughey gave it a look.
Dr. Seuss has been charming generations of children and adults with stories like The Cat in the Hat since the 1950s.
Tell that top-hatted cat he should not be about. He should not be here when your mother is out.
Over his career, he wrote dozens of now classic tales, but some of his writing was never published in book form. It just showed up in magazines. Kathy Goldsmith is an associate publishing director at Random House.
The four stories in this book came from columns that appeared in Red Book magazine in the 1950s. And Dr. Seuss actually wrote a piece once a month for Red Book.
As an art director in the 1970s, Goldsmith worked with Seuss and remembers when he'd come into the office to introduce a new book.
He would gather everybody in a conference room, and first he would read the words to you aloud, and then he would show you the pictures. It was fabulous, because you would meet that book not exactly the way a reader would meet it, because it hadn't all been pulled together yet, but you had that sense of discovery.
The new collection features some beloved Seuss characters and places like Mulberry Street and a very famous elephant.
He was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise.
In this latest book, Horton and the Quaggerbug and More Lost Stories, Horton shows up again with a new cast of characters. Like the Quaggerbug, a mean-spirited little creature who bullies Horton into bringing him treats called Beazle Nuts.
There is absolutely a kernel of the Dr. Seuss that everybody knows and loves in these stories.
Margaret Willison is a librarian in Boston who specializes in children's literature. She says because they were magazine pieces, there are some differences between these stories and classics like Green Eggs and Ham or The Cat in the Hat. One major difference? Fewer of those energetic Seuss illustrations. But, she says, the lyrical language is pure Seuss.
Throughout, you can see him play with tenses in a way that I think is really a trademark of his, where he talks about Horton, he climbed and he climbed and he clumb and he clumb, and it's obviously a made-up tense. And so you see trademark wordplay like that all throughout these stories.
Dr. Seuss's stories continue to enthrall kids today. 5-year-old Eva Steinman is a regular at the Shaw Neighborhood Public Library in Washington, D.C. Her favorite Seuss? Happy birthday to you.
I like it about how it's funny. In the morning when a little boy woke up, a bird came and said, "Wake up, it's your birthday."
And whether your name is Pete, Polly, or Paul, when your birthday comes around, he's in charge of it all.
Lauren McGaughey, NPR News.
With stories that help keep away the blues, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greenlee.
Randall Munroe spends a lot of time answering absurd questions like, what if everyone actually had just one soulmate? Could they ever meet? He gets such questions from fans of his popular webcomic at xkcd.com. A physicist who used to work on robotics for NASA, Munroe takes these questions very seriously. Well, sort of seriously. He uses his expertise to come up with the best answer science can offer, then illustrates his answers with whimsical cartoons. The result is both fascinating and ridiculous. Take that soulmate question. In brief, here's what Munroe came up with.
So I imagined a system of, like, everyone would get on these treadmills and they'd be swept past each other. You know, you get the whole population of the Earth going past each other, making eye contact as they go with as many people as they can, just taking a moment to, like, yes, yes, no, yes, you know, no, no, no.
Of course, this would take some time.
If everyone spent 8 hours a day, 365 days a year on this, you could, in theory, pair up everyone with their soulmates within a few decades.
Munroe has now collected his serious scientific answers to absurd hypothetical questions in a new book called What If? He says some of his best questions come from little kids.
Because I find that the questions from adults are more like they're trying to be as wacky as possible, but the kids ask very simple questions that sometimes have kind of surprising consequences. Like one guy wrote in with, he said, my daughter wants to build a billion-story building. I haven't been able to convince her, like, that this is not possible. And so maybe you can take a crack at it. And so I wrote an article, you know, explaining to her, you know, if you try to build a building progressively higher, here are the problems you're going to run into. Eventually it gets so tall, you know, that it collapses. But then you figure out a way to build it stronger. But then it gets so tall that it's sticking out into orbit and satellites start colliding with it, you know. And then it takes you through all these different interesting physics ideas.
Does it take any of the fun out of somebody's sort of fantasy about a billion-story building when you do answer it scientifically? Does it take the fantasy away?
I don't know. I think, you know, maybe a billion-story building, there are some logistical problems you run into. But at the same time, you get to paint this picture of these orbiting stations and this tension on the building. That, you know, you'd have these cables and these incredibly high-speed elevators that are, like, beamed by lasers sending power back and forth because you have to solve that problem of how do you power the elevators. And, you know, it ends up painting a wilder picture than what you were originally starting with. And I think that, you know, can be even more exciting and more romantic.
Sometimes you wind up with answers that seem very far removed from the premise. I'm thinking of the question about what would happen if everyone in the world gathered in one place and jumped at the same time. And the answer to that question led to another problem that had to be solved involving getting home from Rhode Island.
A couple of different people have tackled this, you know, said, oh, if everyone jumped at once in one place, would it disrupt the Earth's orbit or something? And the answer to that is a little bit disappointing, which is that not a lot would happen. I thought, well, there's not a lot I can say about that. But then I started wondering, like, wait a minute, you gathered everyone in the world in one place magically. That's the premise of the question. But then what happens? And I started trying to figure out if you gathered everyone, you know, in Rhode Island, they would take up an area about the size of Rhode Island, then, you know, how many people can get out of Rhode Island per hour? What's the capacity of all the ports and the, you know, the airports, the ships? How many cars are there in Rhode Island? And then it turns out the rate is not that high. So it brings you to another question, which is how much food is there in Rhode Island? Because there's no one working the farms to supply more food to Rhode Island because everyone is already in Rhode Island. It turns out within a matter of a couple of weeks, Rhode Island would be the graveyard of most of the human race in this scenario.
You also have a series of questions that you don't answer. You sort of call them weird and worrying questions, I think because you find these just a little too strange to deal with. Now, the one that I wanted to mention, because I think it's pretty strange too, is this. How fast would a human have to run in order to be cut in half at the belly button by a cheese-cutting wire?
Yeah, that's in a category of question that I haven't answered because I don't want to think about that. It's just like my skin crawls imagining that. Another question like that was, how cold would your teeth have to get in order for a cup of hot coffee to make them shatter on contact? And that's a question I've never gotten past just the initial mental image.
Do you have your own what-if questions?
Yeah. You know, I'm looking at a studio and I might think if I'm daydreaming in between taping, you know, what if I filled this studio with water? Would the windows be strong enough to hold up? How many playpen balls would it take to fill it if you wanted to make a ball pit here? How much would that cost, you know?
How did you get into this in the first place? You were a physics major in college, is that right?
Yeah, and a friend actually mentioned that there was an MIT program where you could teach classes to high schoolers. So I did one on energy, and I found that the students got way more interested when I started bringing in interesting real-world examples. Because a lot of the time you just do like the physics of a ball rolling down an inclined plane. And it's nice because it simplifies everything, but at the same time, it makes you not really care what the answer is. And so I found that when I picked questions that were interesting, which is the whole reason we want to develop these physics tools in the first place, that people found it was a lot more fun to follow along.
Randall Munro is the creator of XKCD, the webcomic, and author of What If? Serious Scientific Answers to Absurd Hypothetical Questions. He joined us from our studios in New York. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks to a bunch of extremely popular online dating sites, there's a growing mountain of data about how we hook up, date, and generally judge people we don't know. Christian Rutter is the co-founder of the dating site OkCupid. In his new book, Dataclism, he looks at the information OkCupid and other sites gather from their users and tries to reveal the gap between what people say and what they do. Christian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
There are a lot of very interesting charts and graphs in this book. So I want to start with one that shows the average length of messages people post on OkCupid. Mm-hmm. You show that messages now are about just a third as long as they were back in 2005. What happened?
Well, I mean, smartphones happened, basically, and OkCupid developed an app, and people started typing on their phones, which just kind of in a physical sense is harder, but also it's just more chatty, I guess. I don't have a keyboard. It's very hard to go back and edit and all this kind of stuff, so it's just a lot more concise.
One of the nicest surprises in this book for me was that shorter messages don't necessarily mean that the writing is bad or getting worse. Can you talk about how Twitter compares with Shakespeare?
Yes, of course. I looked at a large sample of tweets and looked at the average word length in tweets. And of course, you know, the first blush would be that, you know, with all the abbreviations like U for Y-O-U and thanks, you know, T-H-X, that there would be shorter words on Twitter. And I found that just wasn't the case. They were longer, not only than Shakespearean English, but also in just kind of long form journalism. It's much shorter, obviously, because there's only 140 characters, but it is just as robust in a certain sense that as the kind of an unfettered writing environment.
You spend a lot of time in the book on race, some really fascinating stuff because you're tracking what people are actually doing and saying as opposed to what they might think or profess in other ways. What were the biggest surprises that you found?
All the data on race that I have is from dating sites, but on these sites, black users especially, there's a bias against them. Every kind of way you can measure their success on a site, how people rate them, how often they reply to their messages, how many messages they get, that's all reduced. And so I obviously race is always a topic in this country, but especially now with Ferguson, it's such an emotional issue. And it's rare that you can find data that speaks of how one person of whatever race treats another person of another race in an aggregate and kind of measurable way. And so online data is very good at that, and specifically dating data, because it's all just strangers mixing with each other. And the whole premise of a dating site is to judge people. And so you really are able to tease that out free of any sort of offline social constraints. You know, your friends don't know what you do on a dating site like they do know what you do on Facebook. So that's why I relied so heavily on dating data for that chapter.
You found that, you know, people who might say that, no, I'm not racist, but in the aggregate, the numbers are showing something different. They're revealing clear racial biases.
Oh, yeah, of course. When you ask anybody directly, I mean, you know, even if it's just a computer asking the question, you know, people are like, oh, yeah, interracial marriage is great. I don't care what race my match is. You know, all of that stuff that you'd expect a kind of decent, forward-thinking person to say. But when you actually are observing passively what they're doing, when they don't think you're keeping track, you see a totally different story.
Well, this kind of brings us to the political culture. What did you find there? Is the country as polarized as it looks on cable news?
In the book, I do look at speech patterns and political speech in particular, and found that certainly if you look at divisive speech, that is increasing, and that does correlate to kind of more gerrymandered political consciousness in the country.
So what does that mean? Like, on your dating site, are Republicans likely to date Democrats, or does that not happen?
on OkCupid, I mean, we have found that the thing that matters the most is whether you care about politics one way or the other. If you're ambivalent, you will have a hard time relating to, I assume, someone who's passionate, whether it's red or blue.
With all this data from the dating site, you write about attractiveness. When you break down the data, what have you learned about what men and women think about attractiveness when they're dating?
Well, age is a huge variable in online dating. Women generally like a guy to be the same age as them, up until the guys hit about 40. But when you flip it around, when you look at how men perceive women, it is pretty much a just straight ticket vote for 20, which is the lowest age that I looked at in my data set. So, you know, even 45-year-old guys rate 20-year-old women the best. It's very pervasive opinion among at least the people on OkCupid.
So the data confirm that men are, in fact, creepy.
Yeah, or dreamers, either one, however you want to look at it. I mean, what happens is this is just measuring people's opinions, not what they actually go out and do. What you see when you actually look at what people do, you see the realism set in. So these 40-year-old guys who, yeah, you know, that 20-year-old girls are hottest, 21-year-old girls, the people they actually have the courage to actually go out and message, it's a lot older. It's 30, 35-year-old women.
So, Christian, if I asked you to make a value judgment, because you clearly love diving into all this data, and we'll leave aside government intrusion, but just
sure.
Collecting all this data, tons and tons of info from various companies, is getting all this information about ourselves good or bad?
Oh, I mean, I definitely think it's good. I think to speak to your sort of implicit concern about privacy, for sure. I mean, you know, all of this data, everything in the book, and generally anything you read online about people's behavior on sites is all aggregated and anonymous. Nobody's looking at your personal account. But when you put all this stuff together, you're able to look at people in a way that people have never been able to look at people before. You know, like you have millions and millions of people living their lives through an interface that records what they're doing as they live. And, you know, look, there's no way that OkCupid, Facebook, Twitter, these sites, even added all together, can stand in for the entirety of the human condition. People do all kinds of things that they don't do online, but they're doing fewer and fewer things that they don't do online. And it's the beginning, of, I think, of a revolution in how social science and behavioral science are done.
Christian Rutter is a co-founder of the online dating site OkCupid. His new book is Dataclism: Who We Are When We Think No One Is Watching. Christian Rutter, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Here's a bit of American history you might not be familiar with. In the spring of 1528, 600 Spanish and Portuguese men, mostly soldiers, landed on the Gulf Coast of Florida, hoping to find gold. But the Narvaez expedition was an utter disaster. Within a year, nearly all of the men had either deserted or succumbed to disease, starvation, drowning, or violent death in fights with indigenous people. The four survivors made their way across the continent, living with the natives, until they finally reached the Spanish settlements on the western coast of Mexico. That disastrous expedition is the inspiration for a new novel by the Moroccan-American writer Leila Lalami. It's told from the perspective of the expedition's most mysterious survivor, a Moroccan slave. It's called The Moor's Account. I asked Leila how we even know about all of this today.
One of the survivors was the treasurer of this expedition, and his name is Cabeza de Vaca. And he wrote what is the first travelogue of life in North America, and really the first narrative of Spanish exploration of North America. And I just became so fascinated with this expedition, and with everything that went wrong with it, and with the greed that drove it, and the transformations that it led to, that I just wanted to know more. And the narrative that Cabeza de Vaca provided just didn't give me the answers that I was looking for. And so that's how the novel came about.
And so that this character, the Moor, in the title, we know that he existed historically.
Yeah.
Do we know much about him historically?
Not really. So when I started reading Cabeza de Vaca's travelogue, I started paying very close attention to when this Moroccan slave was appearing, because I'm Moroccan. I was very interested in him. And there were very, very few mentions of him. So he was either identified as the slave or the Negro or Estebanico. Those were the three ways in which he was identified in the book. And all we know about him historically is that he was born in Azamor and that he was an Arabic-speaking black man. That's literally the one line of biography that we have about him from Cabeza de Vaca. I just became so fascinated by him because to me he seemed like a thoroughly modern man. Hmm. Because even though he came from Morocco in 1520, like to me he seemed like the first globalized man. Like he uh-huh. was born in Morocco. Likely, even though he spoke Arabic, he was from Azmour. So likely he also spoke Tamazight, which is the language of the indigenous people of that area. In Azmour, Azmour was under vassalage with the Portuguese. So he probably spoke some Portuguese. And then he moved to Spain as a slave and from there moved to America with the expedition. So he just lived in these three continents. He interacted with all these different cultures. He spoke all these different languages. So to me, he struck me as a very global man, cosmopolitan man.
And tell us a little bit about what these men go through.
Yeah, so basically when the expedition landed in Florida, somebody was sent ashore to, because they had seen signs of the village, and that person found a tiny little nugget of gold. And that was the reason that the Narvaez expedition landed where it landed, which is near what is now Tampa Bay in Florida. And I became, again, just completely fascinated by the fact that all these men would land and everything would be started because there was a tiny little nugget of gold.
I'm wondering how you came across this story initially and how you decided you wanted to make this into a novel.
Some years ago, I was reading a book about Moorish Spain, and I came across this mention of this expedition, of the fact that this Moroccan slave was said to be the first African explorer of America. And he was said to be Moroccan, and I was Moroccan, and I thought, well, how come I have never heard of him? I mean, I've gone to school in Morocco all the way through college. And so how come I have never heard of him? And so I went out and I got Cabeza de Vaca's book about the Narvaez expedition. And instead of finding answers, I actually only had even more questions because the book really didn't include his perspective. It had very little about him. Even though he played a very crucial role for the expedition, for the survivors, the role he played was that he acted as kind of a go-between between the Spaniards and the indigenous people. So he would serve as a translator or a scout. And part of the other reason is that he was not of the same race, not of the same culture. Those are all reasons that probably put him in the position where he was kind of the translator between the two peoples. So even though he played this very crucial role, we know very little about him.
Now your other books are not historical fiction. I mean, you've written about modern social issues. Right. You know, I could very easily see you taking, you know, this story and you know, writing some nonfiction, comparing this with modern events and right. that kind of thing.
Right.
Why did you decide to write this as a novel?
That's a very good question. I think it's because the novel gives opportunities that nonfiction wouldn't have given me for this book. The novel is the only form in which I would have been able to explore what it really felt like to be taken from your home and to have grown up in freedom and then to suddenly become a slave and have to travel across the ocean, and what it felt like to encounter another culture, what it felt like in the flesh to go through these experiences. In some ways, I think it's the closest that we come to the truth is in the form of fiction.
That's Leila Lalami. Her new novel is called The Moor's Account, and it's out on Tuesday. Leila, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
The dancer Misty Copeland appeared recently in a commercial.
It was an ad for Under Armour, and it was one of those commercials that delivered a gut punch of a message.
What you see is Copeland dancing beautifully on screen.
What you hear is the voice of a girl reading a rejection letter she's just received from a ballet school.
Dear candidate, thank you for your application to our ballet academy. Unfortunately, you have not been accepted. You lack the right feet, Achilles tendons, turnout, torso length, and bust. You have the wrong body for ballet, and at 13, you are too old to be considered.
Ouch. It's widely believed the ballet world has tended to promote a certain type of dancer. Misty Copeland is different. She says not so much in body type, but in race. She is an African-American dancer in a mostly white world. She is a member of the American Ballet Theater, or ABT, and she has now written a children's book, partly inspired by her experience, called Firebird. We're hearing music from a famous ballet called The Firebird, which is where Copeland got the name of the book.
The Firebird just symbolizes a lot for me and my career. It was one of the first really big principal roles that I was ever given an opportunity to dance with American Ballet Theater. And it was a huge step for the African-American community, I think, within the classical ballet world. And for them to come out and support me in the way that they did, coming to the Metropolitan Opera House to see me perform that role, I think was just a step in the change and direction that ballet is going.
Misty Copeland dedicated Firebird to her mentor, Raven Wilkinson, the first African-American ballerina to tour the country. In the 1950s, that was no small feat.
She was pretty much chased out when they were touring the South by the KKK, who were threatening that she couldn't perform in their theaters or stay in the hotels that the other dancers were with. And they were trying to kind of hide her and have her blend in and not notice that she was a dancer of color. So she experienced a lot more severe, life-threatening racism than other minorities experience in the ballet world at this point.
Overt racism aside, has ballet been a particularly difficult field for African-American women to break into?
Yes. And I think that the reason is the racism and not wanting to change this very traditional art form that has been, you know, successful in the way it is for so long. And it's hard to be the one that stands out when, you know, in a ballet company you're trying to create unison and uniform when you're in a corps de ballet.
Oh, and that is the way that you dance, and it also may be the body type that you have.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that goes along with just kind of being closed-minded, because I don't think every African-American or Latino or, you know, have the same body type.
But, sure.
But yes, that's been one of the excuses, I think, saying that, you know, African Americans are too muscular or just aren't lean enough. And usually they say, oh, they have flat feet, so they don't have the flexibility that it takes to create the line in a pointe shoe. When people meet me in person, they're usually surprised at how petite I am, because there's this idea that because I'm Black, I just look a certain way.
What, that you should be big and muscular or something?
Yeah, well, but some people even think that I'm still just not right for it. And I think it's shocking because they hear those words from critics saying I'm too bulky, I'm too busty. And then they meet me in person and they're like, you look like a ballerina. I don't understand. And I think it's just something maybe that I will never escape from those people who are narrow-minded. But my mission, my voice, my story, my message is not for them. And I think it's more important to think of the people that I am influencing and helping to see a broader picture of what beauty is.
That leads to something that I wondered about reading this book. It's a very optimistic book. You're talking to a young woman, a girl, and she's saying, I can never do what you do. And you're saying, yes, you can. And in fact, you go on to say more than yes, you can. You say that you will. You will succeed.
Yes.
Did you hesitate before putting down on the page such a voice of certainty?
No. I think that especially young kids need to hear those words, because I think that if you say, you know, it's maybe or it's possible, I think that it's very easy for them to interpret that as no, it's not. There are so many opportunities beyond these top companies that they can be a part of the ballet world in some way. And so I think it's necessary for them to hear that.
So you weren't just thinking metaphorically, well, in some way in life, you will dance and soar. You are actually saying you will do this if you're determined to do it.
Exactly, you will. And I've seen it happen with these girls that come to me, and some of them are really broken because they've been told no so many times, and they're making it happen for themselves. There's a young girl that I'd known since she was maybe 3 years old, a mixed race like I am, half Black and half white. And when I met her, she was considering going into a contemporary modern company. And now she dances with Dance Theater of Harlem. And that's a path that I don't know if she considered, but she's performing classical ballets and she's couldn't be happier.
Now, you are in your early 30s now, right?
I'm 31, yes.
You're 31 years old, which is getting rather late in the career for a ballet dancer, is it not?
Somewhat, depending on the level you're at in your company. The higher you go up in rank, usually the longer you can dance.
So do you have aspirations to break another barrier and, you know, be there for another decade or whatever you might be able to manage?
That's the plan.
Is it really?
I absolutely love what I do, and I want to dance for as long as I can and feel good about what I'm putting out there on the stage. But my goal has always been to be a principal dancer with ABT. Before I knew that there'd never been a Black woman, that was always my goal. I wanted to dance Odette Odile and Khitri and Don Quixote and Aurora and Sleeping Beauty. So that's still my goal, but knowing that it's never been done before, I think, makes me fight even harder.
Misty Copeland is author of Firebird, a children's book. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm David Greene.